Good afternoon. I want to make sure that I can that we can hear both Mr. Haugen and Ms. Tufts. So, Mr. Haugen, could you unmute your mic, please?
This is Josh Haugen, attorney for Parent TDM.
Thank you. So, and can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Ms. Tufts?
Lisa Tufts, Assistant Becker County Attorney.
Thank you. I think we're ready to proceed then. So, Madam Marshall, if you would call the case, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding, calling the case of In the Matter of the Welfare of the Children of LMH and TDM, court file number A201206.
Thank you. And counsel, you each will have 15 minutes if you choose to use all of it, with 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. When you begin your argument, please state your name and the party that you're representing, because these hearings are being recorded. And with that, I'll turn to appellant's attorney.
Thank you, Your Honor. Josh Haugen, appearing on behalf of appellant TDM, parent of three of the minor children. And may I proceed? So first, I want to thank you all for your time in reviewing this matter and for your time today. So we are here to ask this court to reverse the district court's decision that terminated my client's parental rights. So this case began due to a sexual assault perpetrated on child two by a friend of the mother, a person she had actually met online. Child one and child two are not my client's biological children. He is the biological father of children three, four, and five. So this assault occurred while my client was out of state with another child of his. That's not part of this case. It's a child with a different mother. And so a CHIPS case began because of this assault and the circumstances surrounding the incident. So the child that was assaulted underwent a forensic interview where she described in graphic detail the nature of the assault that was perpetrated on her. And during this interview, she had also disclosed some physical abuse in the home or some domestic incidents among the family, but she had denied, I believe at least twice, any sexual abuse had occurred from my client. So during this time, my client returned from Colorado to work a case plan with the county to try to get the children returned home. And as part of that case plan, the parents were required to attend supervised visits at a visitation center here in town. And so my client attended a visit with all of the children present, along with the mother. And there's an argument between the mother, my client, and child two. During this visit. And so approximately 2 weeks after this visit had occurred, a disclosure was made by child two that my client had sexually abused her. And so based on this disclosure, my client was subsequently arrested. Now there's no physical evidence of an assault, really no witnesses up in the room at the time. It was just really one person's story against another.
But so let me ask you, why isn't that enough, Mr. Haugen? Because the judge made detailed credibility findings, which we defer to. So if it's a credibility argument, it seems to me it's kind of an uphill argument for you, because I don't know how we disagree with those credibility determinations.
Well, I do agree, Your Honor, and it is a credibility argument. There were the various inconsistencies within the story, and some other people had kind of doubted the allegations, and that is what we're kind of relying on. And I do understand that is an uphill argument, but it is something I know my client really wanted me to present to the court.
Sure.
So my client was incarcerated based on these allegations, and bail was set at such a level that he remained incarcerated for the duration of the file, really up through the trial. And he had really wanted to try his criminal case from the beginning. He really strongly professes his innocence in the matter, and he really wanted to try his criminal case. But due to various circumstances, including the pandemic, he wasn't able to try the criminal case until after our case was settled.
Weren't some of those circumstances at his insistence? Like he changed his counsel a number of times. He asked for continuances. There were some other circumstances beyond just the pandemic that caused a delay here.
There were some, Your Honor. And I think he'd be the first to admit he did fire his first public defender. But he let him go because he really wanted the case to move forward fast, and he felt it wasn't moving forward fast. And so he wasn't assigned a new public defender after that. He was assigned a standby counsel. And he didn't actually fire that standby counsel. I think the standby counsel probably bit off more than he wanted to chew and had requested to withdraw, and another one was appointed to him. But all that occurred, I think, if memory serves, right around the December timeframe is when that person was let go originally, his original public defender. And then it was just a short time later that we were all stuck with the coronavirus and everything shut down. So he did cause an issue by letting go his original public defender, but then circumstances beyond his control also caused some delays.
But it seemed to me, doesn't the rule speak to that and say the county attorney can decide in what order they want the cases tried? And besides the fact, what I'm not understanding the significance of this argument. It seems to me I saw a footnote in one of the briefs that he did in fact get his day in criminal court and was convicted of these charges and is serving a long prison sentence. So what's the significance of the order here in terms of this appeal?
I think for us, Your Honor, for my client's perspective, it was that he was forced, and I do agree with you, the county attorney can make the determination on which matter proceeds first. That's clear in the rule. But I think the district court also has some discretion on deciding which matter should proceed first based on a client's speedy trial request. And he had, when summertime hit, we were all kind of figuring out how to manage our way through things, and court operations started going again. The district court in our Chips case set the matter on for a hearing, but his criminal case is also moving forward at the same time. So he had finally got his omnibus hearing and he was requesting a speedy trial. And so our request through the district court at the time was for good cause, would you continue our trial out until after his criminal trial so he could fully defend that? And then obviously his guilt or innocence could affect our termination trial.
Well, in hindsight, it would have made it easier for the county if he had been convicted first, since that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. I would agree. And the significance I think it had on our termination trial, though, was he was kind of put between a rock and a hard place, in the sense that you've got your termination trial scheduled now, and then your criminal trial is a month later. Now he had to make a decision on whether or not he should testify in this termination trial. And so after discussing that with him, I mean, even inadvertent statements or little mistakes could have a significant effect on his criminal trial. And so he made the decision not to testify in this Chips trial based on that, based on the rock that was hanging over his head in the criminal trial that was happening just a few weeks later. So he didn't really get a chance to tell his side of the story to
This isn't in the record, and it's kind of neither here nor there at this point, but did he testify in his criminal trial?
I wasn't a part of that, but as my understanding of that, he may have, maybe Ms. Tufts knows, but I don't know off the top of my head. I can't speak for it. I know he represented himself, and I know he gave a pretty strong closing argument from what I heard, but I wasn't sure if he testified. Yeah, so we'd requested that the court to continue this trial. The county objected, and the court, agreed with them that the delaying this case would not serve the best interests of the children, even though, I mean, in our view, it would have only delayed this process by just a couple months. And so ultimately, my client couldn't testify or chose not to testify in this case because of that criminal trial. But the trial court did hear from the child's mother, who had always believed in my client's innocence, really to her own detriment. The court even made a finding that saying because she chose to believe my client over her child was a reason that she should really have her rights terminated or voluntarily terminated. I think child one, who's not a biological child of his, had also expressed some doubt as to these allegations. Ms. Felt had testified, one of the investigators, that an uncle who was called on the mother's side also expressed doubt as to these allegations. And the child herself did give kind of differing accounts on these allegations from the beginning. I think there was a comment where she made that he came into room every night versus another time he came into a room once. I think that's what the court had found as a fact. Even during testimony in one version, the baby was in the room. And then in another version during the same testimony, she actually brought child five, the baby, downstairs and then returned up to the room. During testimony, I think in one version, she says that my client attempted to perform oral sex on her. And another version, she said that he also forced her to perform oral sex on him. And so from my client's point of view, there was really no physical evidence of an assault. There were really no witnesses. The only other person that was there that testified during our trial expressed doubt, didn't believe it happened. And so I guess from our point of view, we just don't feel that the county at the time of that this trial occurred had proved by clear and convincing evidence that child two had suffered egregious harm committed by my client. And that's why we were just asking the court to reverse the termination decision and send the matter back to district court for further proceedings.
But if we did that, then all they have to do is put in the conviction.
Yeah, I understand that too, Your Honor. And I know my client is working on an appeal. At least he told me he was last time I spoke with him. And I know that's a long process for that kind of appeal. But I think that's the only relief that we have available to us.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, Lisa Tufts, Assistant Becker County Attorney on behalf of Becker County Human Services, respondent in this matter. I am asking your honors to deny the relief that the appellant seeks and affirm the order of the Becker County District Court in this matter. As you were earlier discussing with Mr. Haugen, this is a matter of credibility. And as you pointed out, the Honorable Judge Tilmoni did go through quite a detailed list of why she found Child 2's testimony to be credible in this matter. In addition to Child 2 coming in to testify, it was consistent with the information that she gave the forensic interview in her second forensic interview that fall regarding the sexual assault by Mr. Matthews. I do agree with Mr. Haugen that at the first forensic interview, the children were removed from the house under the care of their mother. And Mr. Matthews did not have his contribute at that time to the removal of the children from the parents. It was not until after the positive connections disruption between the family that the allegations against Mr. Matthews came to the forefront. And the forensic interviewer in her testimony did state that it is not that unusual for children to be able to put forth more information later. This child, child two, is 12 years old. She has been sexually assaulted by three different individuals in the course of her young life. She is very traumatized at the nature of all of these assaults upon her. And I think you will see in the testimony, she says that she shuts down. She tries to block it out. She doesn't want to think about this any longer. But pieces of this information comes back at various times. And that is why Child 2 did not disclose sexual abuse at the first forensic interview. She had been at that first forensic interview after a horrific assault in her home that was perpetrated by a friend of her mother's. a man that came to the home for one night and sexually assaulted her in a bathroom. She was focusing on that event and at that first forensic interview. That was foremost in her mind. There were allegations of physical abuse by Mr. Matthews in that first forensic interview. And Mr. Haugen was relying on the testimony of the mother and child one, who would be the biological brother of child two, to discredit child two's testimony. So if we look at the mother in this matter, when she, she invited a stranger into the home that sexually assaulted child two. And child one is her biological brother, and he did not testify, and I think it was just in passing something mentioned in a court report that said that he did not believe his sister. If we then move on to the delay in Mr. Matthews trying his criminal case. Mr. Matthews did discharge his public defender. He was appointed standby counsel. That standby counsel did withdraw. And as Mr. Haugen pointed out, then came the pandemic shutdown of the courts while we tried to figure out how to navigate through this health crisis. And Mr. Matthews, acting as pro se counsel, continued in his criminal case to contest omnibus issues and make a speedy demand for trial, which hampered his ability to get into that speedy demand for trial until all of the omnibus issues were resolved. So that is how he contributed to his own delay in getting that criminal matter heard. At his trial, he did not testify, much like at his TPR trial. He did not testify, but he did give his closing argument with the help of another standby counsel. And in asking you to deny the relief that the appellant seeks to reverse the TPR of Mr. Matthews, as Your Honors pointed out, that relief would be very short-lived, as we now have a conviction beyond reasonable doubt that shows egregious harm did happen to child two, and therefore under the Minnesota statute 260, you can terminate the parental rights to the siblings of a child that was subject to that egregious harm. I believe that Judge Tilmoni laid that out very well in her order that she made in this case. Even if we take the criminal trial aspect out of this, because it happened after the fact, the court has to consider the history of the case and the projected permanency of the parent's inability to care for his children. That's in the matter of the welfare of AD. And as Mr. Matthews had been in custody for about a year, and you did not know whether he was going to be able to parent his children in the near future, that left the court also looking if he was sentenced to the several months that he was sentenced to jail, and he kept his parental rights, how could he possibly parent that child? These children had been out of the home for almost a year by the time we got to the TPR trial. The mother, which was the original cause of the children's removal, had not corrected the conditions that led to their removal. And then we put the egregious harm statute on top of that. There was no other alternative than to terminate the parental rights of both of these parents. And it was not clearly erroneous in Judge Tilmoni's finding that clear and convincing evidence showed that egregious harm had happened to child two. All of the evidence that was presented at the TPR trial substantiated, supported, and left no doubt that some egregious harm had happened to child two. So it's not so much a credibility issue of child two. Everybody found her credible. The forensic examiner found her statements reasonable and that there was enough indication of reliability in her statements, and they were very similar. She may have said red shorts in one place and a different shade of red in another place, but nonetheless, child two can envision these shorts that Mr. Matthews was wearing when he asked her to suck on his middle part. And that, Your Honors, amounts to egregious harm. And I believe that the district court was proper in terminating Mr. Matthews' parental rights to children one, or three, four, and five. And I yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Haugen, do you have any rebuttal?
Your Honor, only one thing that I know Ms. Tufts had mentioned that maybe it was just in passing where child one had stated that he also didn't believe, but I believe Ms. The mother did testify. I won't use his name, but he did say that he just said he told me he didn't see anything and that he doesn't know why she would ever say that. Child two referencing, you know, any accusations against my client. So the mother did testify that child one also caused doubt on it. And so I think from my client's perspective, it's, you know, the county finds child two credible, the social workers and the guardian ad litem and everyone seeking to terminate his parental rights. But the people who really know child two, the mother, the brother, the uncle, all cast doubt on it. And so—
But for purposes of this appeal, it's the judge who counts.
And I understand.
Credibility determinations.
Well, I understand, Your Honor. That's why we just brought the appeal, because we thought that it was an erroneous finding.
Thank you. And the case is now submitted, and we will have our decision out within the 45 days. That concludes our oral calendar.